Abraham Lincoln was a hero of Rex Tillerson's boyhood. As a child in small-town Texas, Tillerson read books on great leaders of the type favored by the Boy Scouts of America. Lincoln was a member of this canon, notwithstanding the complications his presidency created for the Republic of Texas and its successor Confederate State. Tillerson remained personally fascinated and inspired by Lincoln as he came of age at the University of Texas and as a young ExxonMobil executive. He particularly admired Lincoln's ability to confront adversity with courage, find inspiration in challenges both personal and political, and shape leadership through the strength of diversity with extraordinary grace. During the second week of February 2009, Tillerson flew by corporate jet into Washington to attend a ribbon-cutting ceremony at Ford's Theater, where John Wilkes Booth had shot Lincoln dead. A few years before, Tillerson had agreed to chair a $50 million campaign to renovate Ford's. ExxonMobil had contributed, as had one of its major business partners, the state of Qatar. That an undemocratic kingdom, with limited personal freedoms, had funded the restoration of a theater devoted to memorializing the American president who emancipated slaves was an observation politely avoided by the speakers. Working on this campaign has been a labor of love for me, Tillerson said. The next day, he arrived with a few colleagues at the Eisenhower Executive Office Building, next door to the White House's West Wing. Tillerson and his team made their way to Room 157, where Carol Browner, now Obama's chief White House climate and energy policy advisor, joined them, along with some of Browner's staff. Tillerson had asked for the meeting. Tillerson and Ken Cohen did not know whether Obama's anti-oil populism during the campaign would carry on once the president had to govern. They decided to approach their lobbying during the early Obama administration on an issue-by-issue basis. Perhaps the most realistic opportunity involved offshore drilling. Tillerson wanted to push Obama for decisions that might open up the Gulf of Mexico for further exploration and drilling. Polling during the 2008 campaign had shown that voters supported domestic drilling. Perhaps Obama would respond in office, even as he pushed simultaneously for cap-and-trade. The Irving team assumed that Obama's advisors would welcome their perspective, notwithstanding ExxonMobil's heavy spending in the past on the president's political opposition. As an ExxonMobil executive put it, why wouldn't the administration want the views of the country's biggest energy company? There was rarely anything personal or intimate about an ExxonMobil lobbying meeting. As Tillerson had put it in January, the corporation managed Washington with the same PowerPoint-enabled educator's mindset that it brought to bear in Abuja, in N'Djamena, and Malabo. In Room 157, Tillerson laid out to Browner ExxonMobil's principal policy priorities in the United States in 2009. He urged the administration to loosen the congressional moratoria on drilling in American ocean waters and the Gulf of Mexico. On climate, he ticked through ExxonMobil's reasons for endorsing a carbon tax over a cap-and-trade regime. He was just shopping the idea that there was a better way to raise carbon prices in America, recalled a participant. Browner had immersed herself deeply in the coalition-building politics of cap-and-trade, however. The idea of starting over with a carbon tax proposal was, at best, politically impractical. Obama's chief energy policy advisor concluded after the meeting that Tillerson was happy to have a position that nobody was going to embrace, as the participant put it. George W. Bush had narrowed the list of points he wanted to make to his successor during his private handoff conversations with Obama that winter. One topic he emphasized privately to Obama was the importance of America's alliance with Saudi Arabia, and particularly the quality of the personal relationship between the American president and the Saudi king. After the shock of September 11, Bush had invested great effort to rebuild trust with King Abdullah. Bush talked with Obama about how to manage that bond. Obama's White House team was turning away from traditional geopolitical thinking about oil and power, however. As his national security team assembled, for example, the president's closest advisors turned aside suggestions that he establish a special energy geopolitics section at the National Security Council, similar to the one that had managed Eurasian pipeline politics during the late Clinton administration. At the Department of Energy, Obama appointed a cautious scientist with no background in oil and gas, Stephen Chu, as secretary. At almost every decision point, Obama emphasized renewable energy investments and greenhouse gas limitations as the pillars of his energy policy. In bilateral meetings with the Saudis, the Obama energy policy envoys stressed solar power cooperation that could feed the sun-saturated desert kingdom with sustainable electric power. If Obama had thought much about oil pipeline routes in the Caucasus, freedom of maneuver for oil tankers in the Gulf of Guinea, or European natural gas supply security, his instinct seemed to be to set aside that sort of strategizing. 1 month after his inauguration, Obama flew to Ottawa, Canada's canal-laced capital city. By tradition, new American presidents made their first foreign trip to Canada. As it happened that winter, one of the biggest issues in U.S.-Canadian relations involved the geopolitics of oil and the security of American oil supply. The matter was also of deep importance to ExxonMobil. Canada was, by a wide margin, America's largest single supplier of imported oil, at 1.9 million barrels per day in 2008. It was doubtful that many Americans could recite this fact. Their ignorance reflected the fact that Canada posed almost no political risk to the United States, and so its role as an oil spigot for American consumers was inconsequential. That was certainly true in comparison with, say, the role of Saudi Arabia, America's second-largest supplier, located in a rough neighborhood far away, with a record of funding Islamist radicals and imposing oil embargoes over foreign policy disputes. Canada's underpublicized oil bounty included conventional reserves, but also a vast treasure of crude bitumen, as ExxonMobil referred to it. Environmental activists often refer to these bitumen reserves as tar sands oil, evoking images of a sticky mess of a sort that might have trapped unsuspecting dinosaurs eons ago. The dueling language reflected a profound disagreement about the oil's value.